Hello and welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. My name's Steve Hall, I'm the CEO, and each week we're bringing you interviews with our members, friends and guests from across the global underwater technology community. Pod 26, 10th September 2020. Hello everybody, in this week's podcast my guest is John Englander, who is certainly, in my opinion and that of many others, one of the leading voices in the growing understanding of the issue of global sea level rise. Now, I first came across John through a book, High Tide on Main Street, which I found maybe not shocking because I have worked in the ocean science community for best part of 30 years. So I knew about sea level rise. I knew it was a real issue. But what John's book did was emphasize that this isn't some far off event that's going to happen in hundreds of years' time. This is something that is potentially going to impact people within their own lifetimes and by quite a significant amount. John is with me today. We're going to treat this particular podcast very much almost as a primer about sea level rise for you, our listeners, to find out a bit more about it. And you will also have the opportunity through the contacts that I'll put on the podcast notes at the end if you want to get in touch with John or find out more.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure. I'm an American. I live in Florida at the moment, but I've been to the UK many times. You know, I'm delighted to learn more about SUT. And as I've discovered during my last year or so of frequent visits to the UK and giving talks there, my background is a bit eclectic, like most of ours these days, I guess. I studied oceanography as a part of a geology major in college almost five decades ago, a long time ago. And the course that kind of blew my mind was paleogeology, which talked about the ice ages. And in that, I learned that sea level moved up and down more than 100 meters repeatedly. And because I got into the field of diving and on the underwater world, I operated a big diving operation in the Bahamas for a couple of decades and got to do some pretty neat things with submersibles and ROVs and so on. We were a kind of proving ground for a lot of the equipment that some of your members might be using. But I got to go fairly deep underwater in the clear Bahama waters. And back in the early 70s, I noticed there was a shelf at about 200 feet underwater, 60 some meters below. And it turned out that was ancient sea level. It was carved very clearly in the Bahamas bank that we could see diving down to that depth. And because there were submersibles that I got to work with over the years and ROVs, I got to even explore further down the shelf than you could go on open circuit scuba. Mm. And I always was on the lookout for these markers for ancient sea level. But it was just kind of a curiosity because it wasn't going to change in my lifetime. Sea level was now sea level and was quite stable and had been so for 5,000 or 6,000 years. Fast forward, over the decades, I did get to keep looking for markers of ancient sea levels. But in 1997, a change event happened in my life. I was running a program for the diving industry called Ocean Futures. I was the chairman of it. And I invited Jacques Cousteau to come over and receive an award in Florida in January 97. And he and I spent 3 days together, and it kind of changed my life because he asked me to become CEO of the Cousteau Society. It was an offer that I couldn't turn down. I sold my dive business, but unfortunately, he died several months later, and it was a very short-lived relationship, but it was fairly profound in its impact on me. It changed what I did as a career because I took on the challenge for a few months of how do I build upon his platform, the world expert in some ways about oceans as the public perceived it. And he and I talked about climate change, and we talked about actually sea level changing among many other ocean effects. And that turning point in 97 really charted the rest of my career, I guess, or the next several decades up to the present. I took a group to Greenland. I was running a group called International Seakeepers. We had an ocean monitoring system that went on yachts as vessels of opportunity, and worked in part of the Integrated Ocean Observing System that you're very familiar with.
Yes.
But as running that group in 2007, I did my first trip to Greenland. And standing in Greenland the first night, preparing to see the glaciers the next day, I suddenly realized I had a very simple story to tell that would hopefully persuade skeptics, that the oceans were measurably about a degree Celsius warmer since the industrial era, that a warmer ocean was causing the glaciers on Greenland and Antarctica to melt. And as those glaciers and ice sheets melted, sea level would rise meters. And as sea level rose meters higher for the first time in 5,000 years, the shorelines would be pushed inland. And those four points, warmer ocean, less ice volume on land, higher sea level, and pushing the shorelines inland, I thought that was a powerful story. And it all came to me in a bit of an epiphany that first night in Greenland in August 2007. It took me a few years to leave that job and start writing the book and doing the research to kind of make the case, the book you just talked about, High Tide on Main Street. Mm. But that really got me full time into the issue of sea level. And since then, in the last decade or so, that is my 100% passion and mission to understand it and explain it. So that's how I'm where I am today. And of course, it's a pleasure to work with groups like SUT, but I'm a fellow of IMARST. Many of your members will know that, the Institute of Marine Engineering Science Technology. I've done programs with IMECE, the Institute of Mechanical Engineers. So I think all of your professional audiences that involve the ocean or engineering, but as well as economics and planning and architecture, all of these professions need to understand that sea level is going to rise meters higher and that we are now probably past the point of no return.
Mm. And it truly is a multidisciplinary issue, isn't it, John? You know, this isn't, as you say, just one for the oceanographers or just one for the coastal engineers. The whole community has to engage with this.
Exactly. And we tend to think that the glaciologists have this handled or the climatologists. But no, as sea level elevates, you know, 10, 20, 30 centimeters a foot up to a meter, up to 2 meters, 3 meters, it's going to change the world. It will change. It will displace hundreds of millions of people from where they presently live. It is not just a problem for Miami and Bangladesh and Jakarta and cities we think of as highly vulnerable, Venice or New Orleans. It's 10,000 coastal communities, large and small. It's going to change ports. It's going to change global supply chains. It's going to put things underwater that we've never imagined, from archaeological interests to important shore facilities or refineries, power plants, places that need ocean cooling. It's going to cause us to re-engineer the world, particularly the coastal environment, and anyone that's dealing in the world of underwater technology and energy, et cetera. So it's very relevant to your members.
Excellent. Now, the first thing our members, doubtless any listeners, are going to ask is, first of all, how do we know what is happening? Are we talking satellite measurements here or survey measurements taken from land observations? How do we differentiate between land that is sinking versus sea that is rising? So the kind of the basic nuts and bolts to start off with, how does humanity know what sea level is doing?
Sure. Well, first thing is we need to think of two different time frames. One is the recent past, let's call it the last 30 years or a century, where we have good detailed data records. Mm-hmm. And those got much better starting in 1992 when we had better satellite measurements of sea level height. So there's really three different periods we should think about. One is since 92, when we can look at fractions of a millimeter in global sea level change, mm-hmm. With satellite data. Going back to 1880, let's say, when we began keeping meteorologic records and also tide gauge records, gave us kind of the next level of accuracy, if you will, going back in history. But then we have to go back about 20,000 years into what's called the paleo record, the geologic record. It's an entirely different time scale and coarseness of data, but that shows us that sea level moved up and down 120 meters repeatedly, as the ice ages alternated. And so it's very essential to look at sea level in these three different time frames, because we'll get very different degrees of detail, but certainty of, or clarity. Because, again, most people know there's been an ice age. Few would probably know that the last ice age peaked, the coldest part, was 22,000 years ago. When the world had these extreme ice sheets, just 22,000 years ago, not that long ago, that sea level was down 120 meters, 390 feet lower. And the rate of rise since that last ice sheet expanse was up to 4.7 meters in a century, 13 feet in a century, which is astounding to imagine. Now, we're warming a lot faster than happened during that natural period. So we can learn a lot by looking at the natural history of sea level. Sea level basically proves ancient climate change because the ice sheets change over thousands of years. So following ancient sea level, which we can find in these shelves, these etchings of ancient shorelines, we can find it from shark's teeth and stalactites and stalagmites and all manner of geologic measurements that show us where ancient sea level was. I'm sure all of your members have at times found shark's teeth up on cliffs and things like that. And when you back out how the land has uplifted or subsided, we can figure out where was that shark's teeth or those marine sediments at the time of deposition.
Yes.
So we start with the geologic record, but then when we fast forward and we look that sea level has risen about 20 centimeters since the industrial era of the last century or so, we get another level of detail and we're seeing sea level accelerating. Yes. But then since 1993, when we've had the satellite data, both European and American, starting with TOPEX in 92, we're seeing that the rate of sea level, which we thought was 1.7 millimeters a year, had really increased to 3.3 millimeters a year, which is kind of the current figure. But if you start to segment the slope of the data, we realize that now we're over 4 millimeters a year. It's following rapid growth and acceleration. Some people are fearful that we're entering a period of exponential growth, which would be truly difficult to cope with. But so the data comes together from many sources to answer your question. The second thing, besides the fact that sea level, we know in the paleo era, rose 120 meters and then 20 centimeters in the last century or so, and then it's now at like 4 plus millimeters a year, is to look at the correlation between the ice sheets, sea level, global temperature, and carbon dioxide. As I think you and I discussed when we met, we looked at this interesting correlation in a chart I produced, which shows 400,000 years, which allows people to see four ice age cycles, we'll call them, and how that totally synchronizes or correlates with global temperature change and with carbon dioxide levels. And that will be on my website, at johnenglander.net. If you look for the 400,000 year chart, but it's actually, I'm going to do a blog post about it this coming week, but it'll be certainly available there. It's updated recently. And it makes quite clear that over geologic time, we've had sea level, temperature, and carbon dioxide move up and down in close synchronization. And they each have ranges. Sea level moves up and down 120 meters, as I said. Global temperature moves up and down 5 degrees Celsius with the ice ages as a global temperature average. And carbon dioxide typically moved up and down between 180 and 280 parts per million. It's now at 414. It's 40% higher than in 3 million years. And so that's how we get a very clear picture by all of these sources coming together and correlating and painting the same big picture, which we tend not to see until we look for it.
Yes. And I guess given that we are now over 400 parts, that shows us that we're locked in now to substantial sea level rise into the future, doesn't it, John? You know, even if we all stopped burning fossil fuels today and started living in grass huts, this isn't going to go away overnight.
No, that's quite right. And that is the sober message, is that, as you say, even if the world went to zero carbon emissions, carbon dioxide emissions today, even if we could cap CO2 levels in the atmosphere at 414 parts per million, where it is at the moment, sea level is still going to rise because we've warmed the oceans by a degree Celsius. And if we look at the ratio, the historic geologic ratio, that sea level changes over centuries by 20 meters per degree Celsius.
Yes, yes.
It says, yes, we have a lot of future sea level already locked in. We should try and slow the warming as best we can, but we also need to begin adapting. And those in your sector, most people wouldn't think people interested in the underwater technology might be concerned about sea level, but of course they are, because that's where the shore facilities are, that's where the cable crossings happen, that's where the ports are. And we all need to come together on this, as you say. And sea level rise is now unstoppable. We should try and slow it, but we need to begin adaptation.
Yes, yes. It's going to be very much the name of the game, because as you say, it's coastal infrastructure. It's our offshore facilities, ports, harbors, nuclear power stations, airports, coastal railway routes. There's 1,001 items of major infrastructure that take a long time to reconstruct and move. And we can't just keep building higher seawalls for this stuff. Adaptation is going to be the name of the game.
Yes. And it's stunning, because we tend to assume that sea level was a benchmark. Locations are so many meters above sea level, and underwater locations are referenced below sea level. We assume that sea level was datum, that it was the zero line, as if it was permanent. And it's really quite revolutionary to think that sea level is a changing line that moves up and down meters and tens of meters, actually in the long term, hundreds of meters. It's just quite revolutionary. The second thing is that sea level varies in different places. I think something you referenced earlier, and that's for a couple of different reasons. First of all, we know from the tides that the ocean mass, the mass of water, follows mass attraction, that the moon pulls the oceans, and that's why we get the tides, of course. Well, for the same reason, sea level actually follows the varying mass of the planet Earth. And so sea level changes from place to place. There's actually over 100 meters difference in sea level vertically at the same moment in different places in the ocean, something we don't normally see because of the vast expanses. Hmm. But the other problem is locally, we have land that moves up or down, isostatic rebound or subsidence. And so if sea level is rising at, let's say, 5 millimeters a year, but the land is sinking at 10 millimeters a year, as in Jakarta. Actually, it's worse than that. But sea level will appear to rise at 15 millimeters a year. And the reverse is true as well, where the land is uplifting. So we have to look at measurements of sea level in terms of how the land reference platform from which we are measuring things moves up or down. That's one issue. The second thing is that as Antarctica and Greenland melt and contribute their mass to the oceans in the form of water and raising sea level, they actually redistribute the center of gravity of the planet, the mass balance of the planet, its location. And so as the two big ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, which, by the way, Greenland has potentially 7 or 8 meters of sea level rise locked up in its ice sheet. Antarctica has 7 times that, so about 56 meters of sea level rise, again, combined for about 65 potential meters of sea level rise if all the ice were to melt. As those two big ice masses, and they together, Greenland and Antarctica, hold 98% of the ice on land, and therefore potential sea level rise, as they melt and their mass goes from those locations into the general ocean, the ocean mass actually redistributes without getting too technical. Mm. And so we really have to look at changes. And then on top of that, as the currents change, like we talked about this earlier, you and I, the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Current, you know, the Gulf Stream is part of that, of course, but that's going to change. And as that current changes, it changes the relative location of ocean height, if you will. So it's much more nuanced and complicated than we might assume, that you add a meter of sea level rise, it's going to be all over the world the same. And it means that people in your field, in fact, all engineering, but in fact, all communities need to think, get a lot more educated and realize that we thought sea level was a stable line. And sea level being a stable height or line means the shoreline is stable. And that's no longer true, because sea level will be 1 meter higher and then another meter higher. This, whether it's this century or next, we don't know yet. It depends on how much the melting progresses. But we really need to entirely change our thinking about sea level globally, sea level locally, and what it does out in the open ocean is one thing. I mean, if you add even 3 meters, 10 feet of sea level out in the North Sea on an oil rig, it probably is fairly meaningless in terms of its impact. But 3 meters in an estuary or a coastal zone or a harbor or, for the cooling system of a nuclear power plant is entirely different. Mm. Or bridge clearance height. So the height of the ocean has changing impact in different situations. And I think your members will probably all be able to apply that much better than I can in terms of their aspects of work.
Mm. So, John, given what we know from the observations, the satellite measurements, visiting the glaciers, the field work, do we have a good handle on how quickly the ice is melting and how fast the sea is going to rise, by how many meters it's going to go?
Sure. Well, it is hard to put a number on it. But from my work and working with experts and visiting Greenland and Antarctica and being on the front line and talking to people all over the world about this, I would say that this century we're now on the verge of more than 2 meters is very realistic. And with acceleration next century, it's hard to put an upper limit on it in the next century. But I like to tell people that let's start thinking about the possibility of 3 meters. It's a medium figure. Some would say it's a high end, but more and more as the acceleration happens, it becomes a good planning figure. 3 meters of sea level rise, 10 feet, might not happen this century, but it certainly challenges us to think differently in our design and engineering. Mm. And even if we get a half meter by mid-century, 30 years, 50 years from now, that's well within the design life of virtually any building or piece of infrastructure. But we also need to think further and say that within 100 years, so we're talking about the year 2120, that in the next 100 years, we need to be thinking about 3 meters, perhaps more, perhaps a little bit less, but that's as good a target as I can give people. It's a nice round number, if you will. Yeah. Not the three's a round number, but the 10-foot equivalent is a good round number. And I think as we begin to design infrastructure, facilities, communities, power plants, water supplies, wastewater treatment systems, toxic waste dump sites, landfills, everything, thinking about 3 meters on the scale of a century is kind of my best metric for a horizon.
Okay, so to what extent do the decision makers, the policy makers, governments, the likes of the United Nations, the people who need to act to help us react to climate change, to what extent do these people get it, John? Do they understand what's going on?
Well, great question. So the UN does some great work, and particularly their climate program, starting with the UNFCCC, the Framework on Climate Convention on Climate Change, and then the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that does its report every 5 or 6 years. They're very commendable efforts, and they've done a lot of good. But their positions on sea level are probably their weak spot, and it's because of the uncertainty and the difficulty to pin a firm number on it. Mm-hmm. So in the 5 IPCC reports, which have come out over the last 30 years, the most recent one in 2013. The next one will be in 2021 or 2022 now.
Yeah.
They've struggled with putting an upper limit on sea level rise. You have to kind of read the fine print And most people just read the top line figure, which says up to maybe 32 inches or 90 centimeters. And unfortunately, it's in the fine print that we realize that that doesn't include Antarctica, which is a stunning statement that most people, even experts, when I point that out, and I tell them what page to go to in the report to verify it, that there's out of the 90 centimeters worst case scenario for sea level, it includes only 15 centimeters from Antarctica, and that's almost like an asterisk. I call it the Antarctic asterisk, because we know that we could get meters from Antarctica. We just can't put a number on it to the normal requirements of scientific certainty, as you say. But you know, I say it's like planning, when will the next San Francisco earthquake happen? When will the next avalanche happen or mudslide in a coastal area? When will the next tsunami happen? The truth is, we don't know. Now, where we have repeated events, we can statistically say there's a probability of a San Francisco earthquake within 50 years of a magnitude 8, a 10% chance, which is what they calculate. But you can't count on that. Nobody knows. The next San Francisco earthquake could happen a week from now, or it could happen 200 years from now. And what's confusing to most people, I think, is why would sea level have similar uncertainty as earthquakes, tsunamis, which is caused by an earthquake, mudslides, and avalanche? And it's because the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica, which hold the potential sea level rise, those ice sheets, which are 2 or 3 kilometers tall and now have sped up double, triple, and quadruple the speed they were just a few decades ago, those giant ice sheets and glaciers have the characteristics of seismic movements, plates of the Earth's crust. They grind along, and then suddenly there's a sudden movement or a collapse or a fissure or a cavern, and they don't change in a linear manner, and they can't be predicted any more than we could predict the next moment of an avalanche, earthquake, or volcano blowing. And when you put it in those metaphors or analogies, it starts to make sense. So we do know that the ice sheets in the polar regions have changed to the level that sea levels moved up and down repeatedly, 120 meters in a rather regular pattern every 100,000 years. That's geologic history. That's indisputable now. We know the mechanism. It's called the Milankovitch cycle. It's because of the changing elliptical shape of the Earth's orbit around the sun. And I explained that in High Tide and Main Street, on Main Street, as we've talked about. It's a fascinating bit of well-known, it's been known for a century now, the Milankovitch cycle. So we know what triggered the ice ages. But now we've broken out of that natural cycle, and it correlates with the greenhouse gas level. So this is all new information. This case was not made until a decade or two ago. And I've taken a lot of the esoteric science, as you know, and turned it into language that can go across sectors and disciplines and professions. That's kind of where my focus is. And I think we've talked about this institute, the Rising Seas Institute, that we're working to stand up as a new nonprofit. And we'll tell your members about that in due course in 2021. Also, in my next book, Moving to Higher Ground, which will be out in 2021. And again, hopefully we can revisit when that's out. But it's important to take this very technical issues of fractions of a millimeter of sea level and different measuring systems and impacts and put them into common language so that we all can start discussing this. Because the idea that sea level has been level for about 6,000 years, essentially human civilization and our written record, has led us to believe that sea level doesn't change much. But it's when we go back before that and we see that between 22,000 years ago and 6,000 years ago, it rose 120 meters vertically to the present position. And the reason, by the way, I can share with your members, the reason it didn't seem to change was because we were ending the up phase and the melting phase with sea level rising that 120 meters. And we would have been entering the cooling phase, hitting the next ice age cold spot 80,000 years from now, according to the natural cycle of the ice ages. But we've changed things now, as most of us know. Yes. And because because we've gone from the 120 meters of sea level moving upwards, and for 6,000 years had sea level stable, is because it was at the turning point about to enter the down phase of falling 120 meters. But now we're in the super warming era because of the higher greenhouse gases, and sea level is heading up to extraordinary heights and will continue to do so for centuries, as you suggested. So we really are in a new era, and it's both scary and it's exciting. It means that virtually all professions, from engineering to insurance to finance to urban planning to infrastructure and facilities, are going to need to think differently, because our old benchmark of sea level is rising. And there's a lot of confusion. By the way, when I was talking about the ice sheets a few minutes ago, I didn't point out that I suspect your members know that melting icebergs don't add to sea level rise, most of them. But the public thinks that melting icebergs are the cause of sea level rise. But like any ice floating in a liquid, it actually has no effect on the height of the liquid. And I like to use the example, as I think we've talked about, of just ice cubes floating in a glass. Mark the level, let the ice cubes melt, the level of liquid won't change. It's because ice is 9% less dense than water. And it's a magical property of the ice, of the water molecule. And so just prior to freezing, the water molecules effectively expand a bit. And that's why they stick about 10% out of the water above the surface. And as they melt, that the ice molecules compact a bit and take up the same space as water, as the iceberg did. So it has no effect on sea level. And that's surprising to most people and most members of the public. But it's a good point of engagement to talk about what causes sea level rise.
Yeah.
As I said, 98% is locked up in the ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's important for people to understand is that there is no geoengineering way within any reasonable human technology to stop this from happening, is there, John?
No, and we will and probably should try geoengineering, but geoengineering, which does one of two things, either reduces the amount of sunlight and heat we receive on the planet, that's possible. We can also try and take carbon dioxide out of the air to restore it to back what the natural level was between 180 and 280 parts per million. But you're right. In the near future, neither of those things can overcome the extra degree Celsius of heat that's in the ocean. That is driving force that's melting the ice sheets, that's raising sea levels. So no, we are now locked into considerable sea level rise. Yes. By the way, for those in the energy, the since your group, you know, thinks about the energy side, one example you've heard me use that I didn't come up with, but is to think of the extra heat we've put in the ocean as the equivalent of nuclear bombs. The atomic bomb, which famously was used to end World War II, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, very terrible events. But we think of those as units of energy, not in terms of joules or watts, but something that the world can visualize. We are adding, because of the extra greenhouse gases, we are adding 5 atomic bombs of energy every second, 24/7, to the oceans. That's the amount of energy it takes to warm the oceans the degree Celsius where they are now. And of course, the debate is whether we can try and limit global warming to another half degree or another degree, but we're headed to several degrees more. But we've already warmed the oceans. And that's why, even if we could eliminate fossil fuels today, the truth is we have sea level rise locked in, because we've warmed the oceans. Therefore, there'll be less ice on land. Therefore, the oceans will be higher. And if the oceans are higher, the shorelines all over the world, both in big cities and rural areas, will try to move inland.
Yes. That's right. You know, so as you say, you end up changing the shapes of estuaries, coastlines, all kinds of stuff, you know, begins to come out of this. And clearly, if you're a Bangladesh or a Nile Delta, yes, it's it's disastrous for those places. But it's not just those places, is it, John? This really is everywhere.
Yeah. No, it's going to affect it's going to affect fisheries. You know, we talked about earlier that as Greenland melts and the fresh water enters the ocean off in the North Atlantic, that's changing the force on the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Current, the AMOC. right? And that's going to have impacts on not only climate and European weather, but fisheries. As you dump a lot of fresh water into the salty ocean, it's going to change the halene, forcing of ocean currents and the thermal halene. So no, it's going to have repercussions all over the world. It's already in our changing weather patterns. The changing jet stream is a function of the melting Arctic, you know, and we didn't talk about it, but it's a little beyond sea level, but the melting Arctic ice cap, which has been there for several million years, is quickly disappearing.
That's right. And it's changing the albedo, the reflectance of the surface, and all kinds of things.
And the heat transfer. And big thing is that, you know, used to have 3 meters. I dove into the Arctic ice cap the first time in 1985. We had to drill through 3 meters of ice just to get to water in the Canadian Arctic. And today, you can't find 3 meters of ice hardly. It's all thin ice, and the thermal transfer from the heat that's trapped in the ocean into the atmosphere is the reason that weather patterns are changing. Mm. But for all of human civilization, we had a frozen Arctic Ocean. You know, the North Pole looked like it was land almost because it was frozen. But now that's all rapidly melting, and that's not going to refreeze. So it's the opening of the Arctic that is directly tied to the changing weather patterns.
Indeed. And tragically, we lost one of our own, so to speak, in just the last few weeks, didn't we, John? Directly linked to this thinning of ice.
Well, I think you're referring to Konrad Kony Steffen. And yes, in fact, it's a quick and poignant story, and I'm a little emotional. When I was researching my first book, High Tide on Main Street, about this topic of sea rise, I went to meet with Kony. He was then running a program in Boulder, Colorado. He's Swiss by birth, but really probably the foremost glaciologist working on Greenland. And at the time, I was already concerned that sea level was rising higher, but he was a very strict scientist, and I could not get him to agree that sea level this century could be more than a meter, actually 1.2 meters higher. Well, in that decade, we stayed in touch. And in fact, we're in touch just a few months ago before his death in early August this year. And he had now completely switched over. From what he was measuring at his research station, which was in continuous operation in Greenland since 1990, 30 years, he now believed we were looking at up to 5 meters of sea level rise, possibly this century.
Wow.
It's an incredible increase. And the fact that he was such a cautious scientist with Swiss pedigree and ran an American institution and the foremost Greenland ice expert, perhaps. And he died tragically because of climate change, in effect, because the conditions are changing year to year. And he went back to set some instruments the first week of August this year, 2021. And he was part of a small group with a colleague, Dr. Jason Box, another eminent glaciologist. And he walked over to do something, and he disappeared into a crevasse that was unusual and was probably there because of the extreme melting. Mm. And he fell down this crevasse, which was about 8 or 10 meters deep into cold water. And before they found him, he was already dead.
Yeah.
A real tragedy.
Yes. So, next steps, John. You mentioned briefly the Rising Seas Institute. Do you want to give our listeners just a little bit of background about that before we finish off?
Sure. It will be nonprofit, very transparent, working with other professional societies like the engineering societies and hopefully SUT. To say, let's look at sea level as a holistic issue as it affects various professions. Let's put the esoteric science and the glaciology and the models, let's leave that to those experts and talk in language that's accessible to various disciplines, as I've been doing here, and help people prepare for the new era of rising sea level. We're actually considering where to base this. It will be an international network of, needless to say, as a sea level organization, but there's been discussion about perhaps setting a global headquarters in London And it's certainly one possibility. And we do have a starter website, but it'll be more fully developed in the coming months. But risingseasinstitute.org, it's a revision of the name, originally International Sea Level Institute. They're one and the same. But I think the strength is to work with professional organizations like SUT, like the mechanical engineers, like the civil engineers, in different places, because those professionals are who can absorb this information and apply it to their own jobs and their own spheres of influence. And so I think I've really enjoyed your interest in this, Stephen, to help us perhaps get this going.
Yeah.
And the other, for people who are interested, on my website, johnenglander.net, I do a weekly blog post, and I do put out some of this information in easy to consume charts. And we'll also be explaining our progress with the Institute there, as well as my new book, which will come out in early April 2021, which will take this really give people a much better primer on the facts and the science, the case to be made for extreme sea level, and then to encourage us to adapt. This isn't just doom and gloom. In fact, I like to say that rising sea level, like it or not, this coming century, the century we're in, will probably be the greatest economic driver of the century. Because as sea level rises a meter or more, we're going to have to adapt. It's not an option. We have no choice. And while hundreds of millions of dollars of assets will go underwater permanently with sea level rise, we are going to have to recreate those assets, infrastructure, and economies high and dry, or underwater perhaps, with your technology to function. Ooh. So this isn't an optional choice. The truth is, we can't argue with a rising sea and melting glaciers. And I think back to an earlier question I may have not answered. While the geoengineering focuses in some parts on reducing the heat we receive and some on reducing the carbon dioxide, some geoengineering is trying to alter the ice melting, the albedo in the Arctic, and there's even been some proposals to perhaps try and slow the glaciers. That's rubbish to my mind. If people have seen a glacier that's 100 kilometers long and 20 kilometers wide and 2 or 3 kilometers thick, and they realize that that mass will carve mountains and, you know, or carve valleys and move and top off mountains. It's an unstoppable force.
Yes.
Of course, glaciers throughout history, they carved the Great Lakes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Lakes, which we can all see in any photo of the Earth or the Lake Baikal in Russia would be the equivalent. Okay. Cool. Those were effectively gouge marks left by the last glacier 10,000 years ago.
Yes.
I mean, that's the power of glaciers. So I just have little time for people to say, well, let's try and stop the glacier from sliding into the sea. That's impossible. Mm. Man cannot engineer something to hold back a glacier.
Yes, indeed. Brilliant. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you, John. And as you say, it's a challenge, but it's also a massive opportunity for humankind. We can't pretend this isn't going to happen. It will. The only areas of doubt are how fast and how much, and that will become much more clear over coming decades. In the meantime, it's time for us to think very, very carefully about where we put our infrastructure, where we're investing our assets and our pension funds and all kinds of things like that, because this will affect all of us. And hopefully SUT and our sister learning societies and professional bodies will be able to work with the new Rising Seas Institute when it's up and running, and we can help apply our collective professional expertise to helping to solve this massive global challenge.
Absolutely, Steve. I do appreciate your interest personally and as an organization, SUT, and I look forward to working with you and revisiting this. I also might say that for anybody who wants to see a video lecture, I did give a talk that's gotten a lot of circulation at the Royal Institution in February 2019, and that's available on YouTube if anybody wants to see the graphics and a bit of a longer version. But I look forward to coming back to talking to you and the SUT audience whenever you're ready.
So thanks very much, John, and we'll look forward to seeing you again when we're all free to start moving around the world once more.
Sounds great, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to episode 26 of the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT. Find out more about us at sut.org. If you'd like to be featured in a future episode, contact me, steve.hall@sut.org. My thanks to Emily Boddy for composing and performing the podcast theme music and creating the podcast artwork. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. We'll be back again next week with another fascinating guest. And I'd just like to say a special thanks to everybody who's taken us to over 4,000 downloads. Excellent. We're really making progress. See you all again soon. Bye.